Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel. And today I'm speaking with Ilan Stavans and Jorge J.E. Gracia, authors of 13 Ways of Looking at Latino Art, published by Duke University Press in 2014. Ilan Stavans is the Lewis Sebring Professor in Latin American and Latino Culture at Amherst College, where he also serves as the chair of the Spanish Department. Professor Stavans has commented, taught, and written extensively on Latino culture, Spanglish, modern American poetry, Latin music, and both American and Latin American literature. His work has been featured on National Public Radio, the New York Times, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and many other academic and popular media outlets. Professor Gracia holds the Samuel P. Capon Chair and is a distinguished professor in the departments of philosophy and comparative literature in the State University of New York at Buffalo. Professor Gracia's research and teaching has focused primarily on metaphysics, philosophical historiography, language, Hispanic Latino culture, and issues of race, ethnicity, and identity. He has published literally dozens of articles, edited volumes, and book-length projects in both the academic and popular press. Hello, Ilan and Jorge, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for your time. I was wondering if, both of you come from such different personal, educational, professional backgrounds. So I was wondering if you could take a few moments for each of you to tell us a little bit about yourselves. Perhaps we begin with Ilan and then Jorge.
It's a pleasure to be part of the show. I love the conversation in a variety of ways. And the conversation on the radio is particularly attractive to me. It seems to me that the radio has the capacity to make us think in a way that other media seldom has. I come from Mexico. I was born into a small Jewish enclave in the early 1960s and became an immigrant to the United States in the 1980s. I was a journalist for a while and eventually became a scholar. My interests are wide-ranging. I am fascinated by the phenomenon of popular culture, by the role of intellectuals in society. I am passionate about the development of language and how it changes and to what extent that language is a reflection of the society that uses it, and vice versa. And I am also very attracted to deep and complex ways of looking at identity, individual, collective, national, tribal, in terms of civilizations. And that is one of the aspects that brought me as a reader years back to the work of Jorge Gracia. I discovered it in a bookstore. A friend of mine who had been a student of Jorge's began talking to me about him as well, more or less concurrently, and I delved into his explorations of Latino identity, the complexity, the thoroughness, the desire to see it from a variety of perspectives, but mainly from the perspective of clear reasoning in the through the cognitive approach. And so slowly but surely, I was, I'm going to say, trapped or enthralled by Jorge's mind frame. And at one point, I sent him a letter, a fan letter, telling him that I would love to engage him in conversation. And I guess the book started there.
Wow.
Your turn,
yeah.
Jorge.
Yes, well, my turn. Well, it's interesting that actually for coming from very different backgrounds and having very different histories, we do have some things in common that actually have been the basis of our, friendship and collaboration and so forth. And one, of course, is the interest in language, and the other one is the interest in identity, particularly Latino, Hispanic identity. Now, my history is somewhat different in this sense. I came to the U.S. in 1961. I'm Cuban, and therefore I came as a result of the upheaval in Cuba. And I came to the U.S. by myself and at 18, all right? Mm-hmm. And I turned 19 on the day I arrived in the continental U.S. And, well, from there, what happened? I went to Jacksonville for a couple of months and then went to Miami. And from there, then I went to college. I had no family and so forth. So all this was, it's a long history that I'm not going to tell you. But anyway, I went to college. And there, what I experienced was this shock of the language and the relationship between the language and culture and identity. Mm-hmm. And so I began to search for my roots. At the same time, I was fascinated by the way that that language influences one's thought and is also a response or an effect of that thought. That's how I became a philosopher. And I became actually interested in the Middle Ages because in the Middle Ages was where the language of philosophy was put together, as it were. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Chicago to study philosophy, the history of medieval philosophy, and then went to the Pontifical Institute in Toronto to do something similar to that. And after going to Toronto, somehow, I became progressively interested more and more in my background as Latin American and Hispanic and so on. So I worked very hard to learn something about the philosophy in the Middle Ages in Spain and so on. And that led me eventually to Latin America and the issues of identity that have been discussed in Latin America. Mm-hmm. And I started then a kind of a parallel career, one on as a scholar of medieval philosophy and metaphysics and so forth, and another one as a kind of someone who is specialized on Latin American philosophy and thought.
Right.
And that led then later on to the books that I produced on Latino identity and so forth. And what brought, I think, Ivan and Ilan and I together. So I guess that gives me you some background about my thinking and so forth. I must say that when Ilan wrote me that letter proposing that we engage in a project, I thought he wanted to do something in on the photography, if I remember correctly, Ilan. Wasn't that right?
Right.
And yes. You're right. And so I was very busy at the time, and I said, you know, I'd love to do it, although I'm not entirely sure that I know anything about photography and that this would work out. But at the moment, I just can't do anything. And then 6 months passed. I got over my excessive amount of work that I had been committed to. And so then I wrote back to him and said, well, would you be interested in doing the book, this conversations on just art in general, and not necessarily exclusively on photography? And he said, sure. And so that's the beginning of the whole thing.
Ah, there you go. Great. Well, thank you for both of those introductions. And since you've explained the background, kind of how you got to the project, can you speak a little bit more about how you decided you chose this particular form? I mean, there's a very conversational dialogue form that follows the book that takes us through the discussion of these 13 different pieces and touches on just so many themes. So can you speak a bit to how you decided on, you know, that particular way of narrating and writing the book?
Sure, I think I can pick that up. In many ways, once Jorge and I were on the same page, kind of willingly ready to bring our minds together on the topic of art, I would say that the rest came rather easily, and almost, if I can use this image, to the degree that the book, I felt, wrote itself. Mm. It had this structure that immediately became apparent to both of us. And because the structure allowed for a certain number of chapters and for a certain back and forth, it was mainly a way to bring the two of us together to that, to each of the different chapters, and do so mainly with the risk, which we never fell into, of turning this into a mechanical conversation that you are mostly doing as a robot. I think it what made the whole thing so exciting was that it never ceased to be thought-provoking and engaging and surprising as well. And I can tell you, DJ, exactly how it worked. I suggested to Jorge at one point that I, over the years, had been fascinated by a poem by Wallace Stevens that comes from his first book of poetry, Harmonium, that is called 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. And a number of people have used this concept, 13 ways, to bring forth the idea that there is no absolute truth, that the truth is accumulative, and that it is subjective. It comes from a variety of perspectives. And I mentioned to him that if we were going to do something on Latino art, that maybe we could take the poem by Wallace Stevens as a kind of a blueprint and have 30 chapters that would enable us to look at identity and at Latino art through the prism of 13 artists, or more specifically, 13 pieces of art by representative artists of a variety of backgrounds, all Latinos in one way or another, Latino understood in a broad sense, and that each of the chapters, maybe half of the chapters would be inspired by images that Jorge brought in that he was passionate about, and half of the chapters, although 13 is not an even number, one of us would have to add one, that were on the other side, and mainly, meaning me suggesting them, and mainly we came to an agreement of what the 13 pieces would be rather quickly. We wanted to be broad and representative and mix photography and other media with painting, do works that come from Latin America, do works but that kind of allow for the Latino experience to come forth, and other works that are produced here in the United States. We wanted to problematize, I hate that word, but there it goes, what the whole concept is of Latino identity and Latino art. And that they kind of laid the ground for the work.
Yes, actually, the pieces, it was very easy to select the pieces. As I recall, we began by proposing some pieces, and then we quickly agreed on the ones that were better than the others. And I think that part of the agreement was that the pieces were provocative. Provocative in the sense that they made the reader, or us, the observer, think about some particular issue, some particular problem that was controversial and that was important, and it was related to the issue of Latino identity and so on. So we started that way, and then more or less we ordered them. That was not very difficult either. We started out, of course, with the one on Mexico, that wonderful piece, and then we went to the Cuban one, and so on, and moved slowly through them, and then we discovered, of course, that you could concentrate on particular topics on each of them. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing about all these pieces is that they can be interpreted in different ways.
Right.
And so, I took it out to, I started, let's say, with one, or Ilan started with one and the other one continued, and then we would challenge each other, or we would develop the idea and so on. So it was really, I think that Ilan got it right in saying that this was not mechanical at all.
Right.
It was really an impromptu type of conversation. And it was delightful, let me tell you. It was delightful. And it was done through the internet, all of it. And we didn't know each other personally
That's the most interesting part, yes. We did not know each other personally. It was done by creating a kind of master document that would go back and forth. The person that had it would respond, and the other person wouldn't be able to do anything with the document until it came back to him. And back and forth, always waiting to see what type of a thought-provoking approach the partner had taken, and ready to jump in again. And again, it felt as if the book almost wrote itself for that reason. In the end, I guess my experience is that it allowed me to see Latino art in a variety of perspectives that go beyond me. It invited me to challenge my own presuppositions, ultimately it did something that I simply adore, and goes back to the very beginning of this conversation today, DJ, and that is conversation. I think that two minds together, when they challenge each other respectfully, courteously, but also probingly, it can bring forth some fascinating aspects of what the world is about that each of those minds alone wouldn't necessarily be able to do.
Right. And that comes across throughout the book, in that you've mentioned, both of you, that the book seemingly wrote itself, and so there wasn't very much of a mechanical structure to it. And so coming to this as a third party, so we're not involved in producing it, I can definitely tell that's the feeling that you get reading the book. It does seem that the conversation, the dialogue, it's flowing. And although it does center on Latino identity, it doesn't seem repetitious in any way. There are a number of other themes. We're talking about religion or other types of experiences and migration patterns, whatever it may be. All this kind of comes together through this form. So I certainly agree that there is no sense of mechanization to it or overproduction of it, and it really just it fascinates me that the project was able to come together in that way.
Yeah, there is no outline, but there is one thing that is very interesting that I think probably is the most interesting thing about the book, and that is that here you have a philosopher, that's what I am, I function like a philosopher, and here you have Ilan, who is, a literary person, a commentator on culture, and so on and so forth. And we take, we are two different people in the sense of our approach to our thinking and the world and so forth. But that brings to the book a kind of contrast and interest that I think if we had been both philosophers or both literary people, it would not be as interesting and exciting.
Right.
And there is another thing I wanted to tell you, and that was that the back and forth was quick. I mean, I would send back some comments to Ilan, and the response would come back almost immediately, and vice versa.
Yeah, it went back and forth. We had set some parameters for the conversation, DJ, so that everyone had 3 days to respond the moment the manuscript arrived. But sometimes we would respond within an hour. Such was the excitement. Sometimes we would say, I've responded to this, but I want to look back at a statement that I made on my previous answer, and though you can begin, I want to take the opportunity later on to simply go back, and if I change anything, I'll alert you. We often in academia talk about interdisciplinary effort.
Right.
And to me at this point, it sounds shallow. It sounds as if there are all sorts of strategies from the administrators to bring different departments together to see if people are going to work together.
Right.
This was never, our project was absolutely spontaneous. Mm-hmm. It brought, what Jorge is saying is true. When you're trained or when you have the disposition of of being a literary person or being a philosopher, your mind works in a particular way. And I say it somewhere in the book. I learned to appreciate enormously the rigor with which Jorge was approaching the interpretation of a particular piece of art, which in my case would be a different type of rigor that could maybe be more aesthetically pleasing by jumping from one topic to another. Mm-hmm. And I think that the two sides eventually complemented each other. I felt like sometimes dancing a tango where one takes the lead and the other responds and vice versa.
Well, and the
very appropriate metaphor.
Definitely. And the one thing I wanted to also just mention really quickly, you sort of insinuated this earlier, because of your different backgrounds, you certainly disagree and or at least have different approaches to the themes that they are addressed, that are addressed throughout the book. And another pleasant surprise, I think, in reading it was that the times at which you disagree or offer seemingly divergent perspectives, that continues to flow. It's not uncomfortable at all in the book. And you can tell the deep amount of respect that the two of you have towards each other, and that you really are open and approaching this as dialogue, neither trying to convince or convert the other, if you will, to use a religious term, to your perspective, right, or your background and training, which I think, as was mentioned, the focus on interdisciplinarity, perhaps oftentimes that doesn't work as well, in so-called interdisciplinary conversations, or whether that's a conference or some type of a meeting. All can kind of approach, I think, come to the table as you two do in this work, I think this produces really a model type of piece of scholarship and discussion. So, again, just kudos on that.
Thank you.
I did want to turn, as we mentioned a little earlier, to discussing two particular pieces, and I wanted to begin with the piece by the De La Torre brothers, La Reconquista, which was produced in 2010. And so, Ilan, would you introduce this piece to us and explain a little bit about it? What does it depict, and how does it speak to the Latino experience? Maybe we'll begin with this piece in that way.
With pleasure. This is the very first image that the viewer sees after the preface. The title of the piece is La Reconquista by Einar and James de la Torre. They are two Mexican-Americans, siblings, who live in San Antonio and spend part of the year in the Mexican side of California and part of the year in the American or North American side of California. And they are deliberately derivative. What they try to do in their art, which it takes two different paths or routes that they are forking. One of them is their astonishingly baroque work with glass that has made them internationally famous, and it requires much patience and dedication. A single mistake in the blowing of a glass can destroy the piece on which you have been working for a long time. Mm-hmm. And the other one is the drawings and oil paintings and more figurative art. And this La Reconquista image comes from that second part. The chapter as a whole is called The Labyrinth of History, because in attempting to recreate a Renaissance image that they are, Einar and James de la Torre, attracted to, they transpose it to a 20th century Mexico, replace some of the iconic figures of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance that appear in this image with Mexican icons of the War of Independence, of the Mexican Revolution of 1910, and of the Partido Revolucionario Institucional, the ruling party that was in power for almost 60 years. and that it create a sense of overimposition of images. That is, the history that we receive from the past is one, but there is always the capacity to revamp it, to reinterpret it. And furthermore, I think what they are saying, and it's something that I take to heart, is that Latin American art, and that's why I thought this should be, if not the first, at the very beginning of the book, Latin American art finds originality in derivativeness, that it seeks to use tools, genres, parameters that come from outside, predominantly from Europe, makes them native by acclimating them to the environment in Latin America, and then revamps them all together to produce something that will be seen as a kind of response to the region's history, and also a response to what Europe's art is all about when projected to the former colonies.
Mm-hmm.
In a recent book that I just published called The Quixote, The Novel and the World, there's a chapter there on this type of aesthetic that I say comes from a short story by Borges called Pierre Menard, author of The Quixote, in which the great masterpiece Don Quixote is rewritten, and according to the narrator, is no longer the same. In the act of rewriting it makes it different, and the act of rereading it in a different time and place will make the story become something altogether new. I love the work of the La Torre brothers. They are roughly my age. They are roughly, they have roughly a similar experience to mine, having been born in Mexico, came to the United States, and the clash of cultures. Hello?
Yes, we're still here.
Okay.
Are you there?
Yeah, I think the three of us are here.
Yes, we're also here.
So the clash of those two cultures ends up producing something that is unique. And before I conclude this section, I want to tell you that this book with Jorge has been really exhilarating to produce. And among other things, it has been an invitation to me as a thinker and as a writer to go beyond what we said on the page, on these pages, and start exploring the art of one or more of this artist in depth. I just recently did something on Adal, a Puerto Rican, New Yorican poet whose work is the subject of the very last chapter, Twisted Tongues, on a piece called the La Spanglish Sandwich Bodega Bag. And I would love at one point, and have begun a conversation with Einar and Hamex, to delve deeper into their art and look at the work that they do with crystal, with glass, and their other type of work, more pictorial, to turn it into the subject of a single book.
Right. Great. Thank you for that. And Jorge?
Well, this piece is really a monumental piece by the Relatore brothers. The fact that it's a triptych, that it is done on a kind of religious theme, the background and so forth, taken from another author, and that it tries to go beyond and adapt that, as Ilan was saying, to another set of problems or issues. It's extraordinary. I mean, you could spend hours and hours writing about this piece, and
so
this
true.
Makes it
yes.
really an extraordinary piece. Now, one of the interesting things, it looks to me like it's a kind of conceptual palimpsest. You know, a palimpsest is a manuscript in which there was writing first, and then writing, other more writing was put on top of the original writing,
right.
and so on, so that you have various levels of meaning and interest. And here, of course, the notion of the reconquest, la reconquista, is really fundamental, because you could read this as saying that, okay, there was this reconquest in Spain, and now the Spaniards came and conquered Latin America, and now there's going to be, there is already a reconquering of Latin America by the peoples of Latin America. Mm-hmm. So that we have moved, we are achieving what the Spaniards achieved in the Iberian Peninsula, but in this new context. And then there is an ironic side to the whole thing, because the play on the changing the faces of the individuals from the originals in the piece to Mexicans of today and so on. That is just enormously rich.
No, it certainly is. And it's, as you mentioned, one could spend hours writing about it. One could spend, as I've had over the last couple of weeks, reviewing your work, this book, just looking at it and analyzing it. And I think it spurred a wonderful conversation in the book itself between the two of you, a wonderful dialogue where you discuss the subversive aspects of the piece, its satirical take on this old, master painting that's Hans Memling's The Last Judgment, and as well as you've mentioned the labyrinthine quality of this piece and how that speaks to the ambiguities of the historical experience for Latinos, right? So those are things that are covered in this chapter. One thing I particularly found interesting that the two of you, it seemed towards, I don't know if it's the middle or end of the chapter, to take different approaches as to what defines Hispanic culture, civilization, and identity. What is it that holds all those things together? And I was wondering if you could take a few minutes, each of you, Jorge and Ilan, to speak about your particular perspective. One of you, there's a debate in the chapter as to whether there are actually, I think this was Ilan's perspective, distinctive traits or essences that make something Hispanic, or were there these shared familial similarities or like a shared history? I think that was more of Jorge's perspective. So would the two of you talk on that a bit?
Sure. You want to go first, Ilan?
No, you go first.
Oh, okay, good. Well, this is an area of a strong disagreement between Ilan and me, because I have devoted some time to the thinking about how is it that ethnic groups, and particularly Latinos or Hispanics, depending on what you want to call them, although the two terms pick different populations.
Right.
But anyway, so what is it? How do you conceive the unity that this group has? And my view is that it's impossible to come up to identify constants that inform the entire history of Latino history or Hispanic history. It's very difficult to defend that. And because of this, I have proposed that instead of thinking in terms of a set of conditions that are satisfied by this particular population or anybody that fits this category, what we need to do is think in terms of what a family is. Now, in a family, the members of the family may share one characteristic or two or whatever, but they don't share all their characteristics. Mm-hmm. And it is the case that they do not share all the members of the family share a single characteristic. Not everyone in the family has the same nose. Not everyone in the family has the same intelligence. Not everyone in the family has, the same good looks or bad looks or whatever. But at least some members of the family share something. So there is a kind of a chain involved here. And so a family resemblance. So if one thinks about Hispanics or Latinos as a group of people that have a kind of family resemblance, not in terms of looks or anything like that necessarily, although it could be that way, then you can explain how there is continuity in the group and how common features occur and common experiences develop. And that's the way I propose to think about ethnic groups, and particularly Latinos, Hispanics. While for Ilan, there is an essence or something which identifies us.
Right. For me, the perspective is different. There is a shared commonality that is defined by the cultural, the historical upbringing, and that might come to us through language, through the set of moral values that have been established, and by simply having been in the same geographical space, even though sometimes as a result of immigration and other fractures, that shared space is no longer there. For the most part, it also has to do with a kind of a depository of memories that are introduced by the civilization itself, in that create a sense of unity or continuity. At one point, DJ, in the chapter, I believe it's in that chapter, but I might be wrong, there is a moment in which Jorge and I talk about not so much the same syntax or grammar that people might have when speaking a language or behaving in a particular way, mm-hmm. but the syntax and grammar of dreams. And mm-hmm. one question that has plagued me, that or at least that obsesses me, to which I find no answer, but I have come to realize that the answer really is irrelevant, that it is the asking of the question that I find most interest, is dreams. Do people from the same culture or civilization have a similar approach to dreams that differs from people in other culture or in other languages? In other words, do people right now my age in Germany and somebody my age in South Korea and myself here in the United States of Mexican background, do our dreams explain themselves differently? It might be really a redundant, more playful topic than anything else. It might not lead too far, but I think that the grammar of dreams in many ways is also an explanation of how cultures or civilizations get to be made.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both.
Yeah, the only thing is that dreams change, and with time they change mm-hmm. in the context and so forth. And that's what I like to emphasize. And Ilan likes to emphasize the commonality of some elements.
Right.
Well, there you are. The disagreement.
Well, it was, but that disagreement.
That's right.
The way the disagreement worked out in the book, I think, was great, because the two of you, there's a number of exchanges where you're really trying to figure out each other's perspective. So, as you mentioned before, since you haven't met each other, you really didn't know where this discussion was going to go. And eventually, in the chapter, you figure out, okay, we do disagree on this. You know, we're coming to this from different perspectives. You know, and so,
but you know. You know, DJ, I want for you and for your listeners mm-hmm. to just think of something that is in the background on all this, and that it's really crucial for the making of a book like the one that we're talking about. Really, two people that don't know each other decide to work together on a project that will not be there to advance anybody's career, for the sheer pleasure of finding out how the other person thinks. Mm-hmm. Had we known each other for many, many years, I think probably we wouldn't have done the book. And uh-huh. probably the element of surprise in the book is that the fact that you're not only answering the question that has just been asked, but trying to figure out who's in front of you, mm-hmm. how the person thinks, mm-hmm. would disappear. And I love this book for that reason. I love the book because we both entered it with certainly a degree of respect, but an absolute lack of knowledge of, you know, the most basic elements of how the other person functions in life. Mm-hmm. Just from reading somebody else's work, you don't get to know if they are, I don't know, punctilious, or they get angry quickly or impatient with themselves or whatever. And so here, all those elements are part of the dynamic. And that made, at least for me as a participant, the work kind of a thrilling experience.
And it's certainly, I think it resonates with the reader in that it's something that I could relate to as I try to carry on conversations with people just in, you know, my daily routine. I take a light rail train from, you know, Pasadena to downtown Los Angeles to make my commute, as part of my commute. And oftentimes I hear conversations that I would rather kind of like to be a part of, and I try to butt my way into them, and I don't know where they're going to go. And sometimes these conversations end up very nicely, and other times we're talking about politics or some other maybe controversial issue, and I completely disagree with this person, and it kind of blows up in my face, and I got to sit there for 5 minutes or just being really uncomfortable. But so, you know, I think that, you know, in hearing you, that I'm sorry, in reading the two of you, you know, come to an understanding of each other and being okay with that understanding and being okay to disagree, it really was, you know, again, it really is a gem. It is something that I really do appreciate about the book. And there's something about the form, I think, that you decided to conduct the project in this way that allows that to come through, whereas in other types of works, as you mentioned, you know, work that you would use to a monograph or sorts you would use to advance your academic career would not allow this, you know, so that is certainly true. Well, I know that we have limited time, so I definitely want to get to the next piece we're going to discuss, which is José Beria's Segundo Su Instinto, and Jorge, you're going to lead on this one, right?
Yes. All right. This is a wonderful piece. I mean, I not only like the thought that is behind it, but actually I like it physically. It's aesthetically very pleasing. And one of the interesting things that I find in the piece, and I can't remember exactly what I said about it before, but what I find is this, what I mentioned before, that the pieces here in this book suggest various ways of interpreting them. Mm-hmm. And here you have one that if you go by the sort of the first impression, you immediately, because the author or the artist is Beria, who's Cuban and of course left Cuba and lives in Miami. And what you have here is a human, half animal, half human, running away, then you immediately say, okay, this is a piece about the flight of Cubans from Cuba. So basically, that's what stands out. But then you can look at it and say, well, hold on. Is this just about the particular event? Well, then you can say, okay, you extend it to the event of immigrants from other places that have to leave their countries and so on, their plight and so on, and the reasons why they leave and so on. And then you go into another level and say, well, can we think about just any kind of flight that we have to engage in? Mm-hmm. I mean, the circumstances in our life or lives in which we have to abandon our comfortable position, our comfortable the way we think and so on, and move into different areas, and that they pose a risk. At the same time, while we're doing that, we're carrying with us baggage, suitcases, the two suitcases that you see in the picture, right. And we are guided by some perhaps idea or that it's like a bird. And here you have four birds that precede the figure that is running away from what?
Right.
It's running away from some danger, from what is perceived as a danger, namely a knife and so forth. And so that's another level of exploring that. And you can then expand that in various dimensions, so that the figure, it is a very common experience of human beings that they have to at some point in life, abandon something and then move on to something else. And here makes it very dramatic, and all the elements that are important in such situations are here. Like, you know, the figure on the left where you have something that is like blowing wind. Mm-hmm. And so you are being pushed away, and at the same time you're rushing and so on. So all of this brings to home a number of ways of interpreting it and therefore enriching your experience.
Right. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Ilan?
For me, the piece is about the exile as well, but Jorge was mentioning it, in a broader spectrum. It is about the experience of movement, and I believe one of the early thoughts that I had when beginning the discussion in this chapter with Jorge was the difference between the ways that we refer to people that have that are in the process of moving. I'm thinking of an immigrant, I'm thinking of an exile, I'm thinking of a refugee, I'm thinking of a slave, I'm thinking of a traveler, I'm thinking of a tourist. In other words, people who, for one reason or another, find themselves not in the place where they were originally from, either voluntarily or otherwise, and they have to relocate. I think we are creatures in movement and creatures of movement, and the piece by Vedia really speaks to one degree of emotional force that makes it very attractive to me, and that is already present in its title, Siguiendo Su Instinto. What ultimately all travelers have, all tourists, all exiles or refugees or immigrants or maybe migrants, meaning an immigrant within the country, like say Native Americans or somebody that moves from one house to from one state to another, is that they have their instinct. In the instinct, it might be difficult to describe, but it's ultimately the GPS, the coalescing force, the anchor, the map, the compass that will allow this individual to create a new home, however long that might take, in the new habitat. If you don't have anything, you only have hope. That's what often the cliche says. In this painting, you have your instinct, and your instinct will take you somewhere else, and ultimately lead you to find some sort of roots in the capacity to recreate home. We have in Spanish a beautiful distinction between casa and hogar, which is also available in English, a house and home.
Right.
And the instinct is very clear in knowing the difference between both of them. We know that a house is just an architectural structure, but a home is the warmth that comes with it.
One of the things that that really fascinates me is the bags that the figure is carrying.
Right.
Because it seems that, you know, it could not leave those bags.
Right.
And wherever we go, we carry these bags. Even in the academic profession.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're trying to get away from a rut, let's say. We're in a rut. And so we're not going anywhere. And so on. And all of a sudden, we want to chart a new course, take a chance, and look for new avenues, new interesting places to go conceptually, but we can never leave those bags away. And what those bags contain, it's not clear here. What is it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, normally when you go away, it's your clothes, the things that you value, and so forth. But, you know, for each of us, it may be something different. So I related to this personally about many times that in my life I had to make these changes, not only leaving Cuba and so forth, but in my academic life, in my career.
Right. And, you know, speaking So you bring up the, both of you discussed this universal quality that this of movement and, you know, even migration that, that the painting speaks of. This led the two of you in a discussion in your exchange to talk about escape and this, you know, the myth of escape and particularly escaping from certain aspects or, you know, constraints of Western culture. And so I was wondering if you, and in one point, I think it was, I'm trying to think if, I wasn't sure if it was you, Jorge, who brought up the baggage as those being, you know, if we're fleeing for something within our culture, some type of, you know, tyrannical aspect of it that seems constraining or pressuring it, that desire to escape it, which is instinctive, also we have the almost inability, it seems, to let it all go, as you mentioned. So
exactly. That's
what the baggage, at least in your interpretation, kind of represents, you know, our desire to both flee some aspects of our culture, but still an unwillingness to let it all go. Could the two of you perhaps maybe just exchange briefly on that? It's titled here, you guys kind of refer to this here as the myth of escape, but really it's about this, there's something kind of inherent maybe within Western culture that drives an instinctive kind of response to try to escape it through taking, I don't know, vacations or, you know, expressing oneself through art or written form or something like that, right?
That's right. You want to say something, Ilan?
Yes, I think that escape is something that inevitably we are drawn to, and that defines our lives in multiple ways, and that ultimately makes us who we are. We might say jokingly, but we escape the place of our birth, or the family that raised us, or the first lover that we had. Just as we are compelled to be in that family, that we are happy to be in that place, we also feel suffocated by it, and we want to escape, because we are given this sense of freedom, of exploration, of travel, of going outside, and because we feel that often that we are trapped in our own being, that the very constraints of our identity, of our selves, are a kind of prison. I love someone like Shakespeare or someone like Cervantes, because it seems to me that through their art they are capable of taking vacations from themselves, of escaping who they are and becoming a Hamlet or becoming Othello or becoming Ophelia or becoming Sancho and Alonso and Don Quixote and what have you. And we often talk about the escapist quality of art or the escapist quality of routine, the fact that routine gives us this grounding element that makes the body come to a kind of rhythmic, mechanical approach while the mind can escape, while the imagination can go off. So all of this to come back to the image of Bedia and to come back to that very concept that I think is at the very core of Western civilization. When even Freud talks in his thesis on psychoanalysis that we look for ways to escape the very powerful superego and want the forces of the instinct to be expressing themselves all the time as if we were savages, we are always in the middle of a battle. We are that battle itself. And forms of escape are what drive us in multiple directions. The immigrant or the exile or the refugee ultimately have something that others don't have. That is, they can escape. That doesn't mean that they solve their dilemma, but they do get to move something that all of us in one way or another are hoping, even with the imagination, to achieve.
Right.
And the point about this escape is that it's always accompanied by, of course, a rejection of something, but at the same time, a goal or some idea that you have. So the birds here are in front of the figure, just drawing the figure forward, but we don't know exactly where the birds are going to land.
Right.
We don't know what's there. So it's a kind of an idea of moving and leaving, but we don't know what that ultimate home or house or hogar, as you pointed out, is going to be, and whether it's going to work or not. So it's a very perilous journey, and yet we all the time, in order to continue to be vibrant, we have to do it.
Yeah, that's so true. It seems to resonate with me, because I think as there is that element of peril or uncertainty that comes with, you know, movement or migration or escaping. At the same time, there is sort of a dichotomy in that there's a sense of comfort in it. You know, there's a sense of comfort in the promise of whatever it is we think we're fleeing to or escaping from. Maybe it's more of what we're escaping from than what we're going towards. I don't know. Definitely both of those aspects seem to speak to me, and that this painting does, you know, a great job at provoking that type of thought. Okay. Well, thank you both for your comments on these two pieces, and again for producing this work and coming on our channel. I did want to give you, as we wrap up, each of you just a brief moment to tell us what it is that you're working on at this point. And perhaps, Ilan, we start with you real quickly.
Yeah. And I am working on a number of different projects. Maybe the most significant and connected to this is that I am almost at the last stages of a book on selfies as a cultural phenomenon. Why is it that we have become so fascinated with turning our iPhone to photograph ourselves?
Right.
Are we more narcissistic than any generation that preceded us? Has the selfie itself changed our perception of who we are? Mm-hmm. And to what extent the sending out of the selfie on social media is a form of falsifying who we are and turning it into some sort of capital so that we will attract others depending on what our missions are. So I've been writing about the history of portraits and self-portraits, about the first Kodak camera and Fuji, and about this, it seems to me, extraordinary phenomenon of the selfie as something that needs to be seen from the philosophical, psychological, cultural, technological sides, and maybe attempt not to answer, but to offer some questions connected to it.
Right. Sounds fascinating.
All right.
What happened?
Yes. Actually, I'm finishing all kinds of little projects, articles, and things that people have asked me for. But at the moment, I'm going to make room for writing a kind of intellectual autobiography from the time that I arrived in the U.S. until the present, because it's sort of the last one thing that I want to do in my life. In other words, a thoughtful and a narrative for myself, really, for my own benefit, about finding out how I arrived to where I have arrived, and what has been the tone of my life or the tenor of my life. And on the way, I will have a philosophical axe to grind. Namely, I'm going to try to point out what the good life is. And so that's my project at the moment.
Great. Well, both of those sound fascinating. Both of those, I assume, are going to come out in book form. That's how you're anticipating producing them. Is that correct for both Ilan and Jorge?
Absolutely, yeah.
Gotcha. Great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you again, both, for coming on to New Books in Latino Studies. It's been a pleasure.
Wonderful. Thank you for having us, and thank you for allowing the conversation to continue.
Certainly.
Thank you for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and I hope you've enjoyed my conversation today with Ilan Stavans and Jorge J.E. Gracia, authors of 13 Ways of Looking at Latino Art, published by Duke University Press in 2014. If you'd like to contact us, please send us an email to newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com. You may also watch for our postings on Facebook, or we can also invite you to comment on iTunes if that's how you download and listen to our podcast. We also invite you to purchase the book, 13 Ways of Looking at Latino Art, and you may do so by following our link to Amazon on the page. Thank you so much.